It is a dreary night, and nice fog setting in out there, making it difficult to get from one place to another, and a little bit of cold to add to the wet, and yet you all have made the effort to be here this evening, and it is an encouragement to me, and I know to the congregation here, to see each and every one of you here, especially those who are visiting with us this evening. The cold and wet was made a little bit more enjoyable with some chicken stew this evening over at the Bragwell's home. And it was a Bragwell home I had not been in yet in Franklin County, and so that was enjoyable as well. And we sure are enjoying the company of everyone here this week. But of course, most of all, we enjoy the opportunity and appreciate the opportunity we're able to take this week to open up God's Word and to consider it together. And what I want to look at this evening is the story that is given for us in 1 Samuel chapter 15. We have looked at the introduction story to the period of the United Kingdom there in 1 Samuel chapter 8, where they asked for a king. And then last night we considered the time when Samuel basically chastised and brought consequences on the people for having asked for a king shortly after their victory over King Nahash, which was Saul's first military exercise, you might say. 1 Samuel chapter 13, just right after that kind of high point in chapter 11, and then somewhat as the celebration carries into chapter 12, Saul already begins to falter. He does not last long as a good and righteous king. And the first thing that happens is his cowardice shows in a conflict with the Philistines, where he was supposed to wait on Samuel. And as the battle gets heated and he becomes afraid that Samuel will not show up, he goes ahead and offers a sacrifice that he has no right to offer. And then Samuel shows up and he begins to make his excuses. He further illustrates that same mentality and that same avoidance of blame and responsibility here in 1 Samuel chapter 15. And it is here that we find emphatically him being told, "That's it. You are done. The kingdom's going to be taken away from you. And there's really no getting around it at this point. There's no way of fixing what has been broken because he's broken it so soundly." The occasion is that he, Saul, and the army of Israel are told to go and to utterly destroy the Amalekites. And the conflict between the Amalekites goes all the way back to the period of the Exodus, when they were harassed by the Amalekites as they were leaving Egypt, at a time in which really they were not trained warriors, they were all slaves. But of course God gave them the victory on that occasion. And as a result, there is the vengeance of God being brought about on this occasion. And God says, "You go and utterly destroy everything and everybody, and you don't bring anything home." We pick up in verse 10 of 1 Samuel chapter 15. It says there, "Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, 'I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not carried out my commandments.' And Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, and it was told Samuel, saying, 'Saul came to Mount Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, and he turned and proceeded down to Gilgal. Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord, I have carried out the command of the Lord." But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears, and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites. For the people, they spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. But the rest, we have utterly destroyed." And Samuel said to Saul, "Wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said to him, "Speak." Samuel said, "Is it not true that though you were little in your own eyes, you were made the head of the tribes of Israel? And the Lord anointed you king over Israel. And the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord?' And Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord, and went on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil, and sheep, and oxen, the choices of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Samuel said, Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, He has also rejected you from being king. As you continue on reading, it just gets pitiful. I mean, Saul goes to groveling and begging and pleading, and even tears away from Samuel's garment, at which point Samuel uses that as an illustration and says, So shall God take away the kingdom from you. And finally, towards the end of the chapter, Saul gets to the point where he basically says, Okay, I'll show some sign of repentance here, and let's go have a sacrifice. But that is not any sign of hope, really, as you continue on reading the story. But looking at why Saul is rejected and what all happens here, I think there's a number of lessons for us as we make some observations from the text that we've just read. The first observation I want to make is that Israel was a tool. They were a sword in God's arm. And they were not only His chosen people, but they were His chosen people not just to live and to fulfill His purposes within the confines of their borders, but they were also His chosen people to go do what He wanted to other nations. And there is a distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament that is illustrated here, that because they are a physical nation, because God's people at this time in fact have a standing army, in fact are a literal nation, that when God wanted to bring judgment on other nations, He had a ready-made people to do it. I'm ready to bring judgment. Here's the people to do it. You go and you take this judgment. Now, there's other occasions where God would indeed use the Babylonians to bring judgment, the Assyrians first to bring judgment on the northern kingdom, and then the Babylonians to bring judgment, and so forth. And He would topple kingdoms using wicked people to topple other wicked people. But here's a case in which God's purpose is for righteous people to be His sword and be His tool. We are looking at a people who had a much more physical covenant with God than we do. They were born into the covenant. You didn't become a Jew by learning the precepts. You became a Jew by having parents who were Jews. And so you were intended, certainly, to learn those precepts and to learn what all it meant, the law and so forth. But that is not primarily what made you a Jew. It was by birth. And God, when He promised them blessings and when He promised them victory, it was physical in nature. If they were obedient to God, they would receive indeed physical blessings. Now, we have general ideas of blessings. We have passages like Matthew 6 and verse 33 in the New Testament. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and all these things will be added to you. But the health and wealth gospel that is preached by so many denominations is a distortion of anything we're promised in the New Testament. We're not told that if we're obedient, we'll have the blessings that the Israelites were told that they would have. They indeed would have a good crop. They indeed would have success in a very physical way. And God promised that to them. And that is a great distinction between their relationship to God and our relationship to God. Certainly our relationship to God, we are not a physical nation. We do not all live in the same area. The nation of God, the kingdom of God today, has no borders, no physical borders, but it spans the whole world, and we are connected spiritually and not by blood. And not only that, but in addition to the fact that we do not have borders, our enemies don't have borders. Our enemy is Satan. Our enemy is the those that do the bidding of Satan. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, And in verse 3 beginning, it describes the type of warfare that we are involved in. It says, "For though we walk according to the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses." We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your disobedience is complete. It's a battle of ideas. It's a battle of concepts that we are engaged in. Now, understand that just because we have spiritual enemies, that doesn't mean that there is not a time to take on physical enemies. God has still given us general principles in Romans chapter 13 that the government has been established so as to bear the sword against those who do evil. And that's their purpose. And I don't have a problem, and I'm not pacifist that I would say that there is never a purpose, there's never a point that war should be taken on, or that brute force should be used in order to exact judgment on those who would do evil. I understand that. But as Christians, we don't have the same type of calls that they had, and we don't have the same kind of information that they had. We have very general information. We have to decide who the evildoers. God's not there to say, "Here is Amalek, I want you to go destroy them." Now, I say all that to say this. There is a comparison to be made, I think. When God told Saul and the Israelites to go destroy the Amalekites, He's not just telling them to go and destroy the Amalekites because they have a territorial dispute. They have some political dispute that can only be solved by war. He's telling them to go and exercise His judgment on the Amalekites. It's His decision. And so when they go, they have no rights when they march into Amalek to decide who lives and who dies. That's what God's decided. And I suggest with our warfare, we are in the same boat. When we fight the fight of God's kingdom, when we fight the fight of truth, we are not the ones who get to decide where and when quarter will be shown to those who are teaching false doctrine. That's God's call. And I'm afraid that sometimes, especially people of my generation, I have read and heard things said about people who have fought the battles of years gone by. And I read an article some time back by somebody who was around about my age, his early 30s. And he was sitting there wondering if people had just shown more kindness and more mercy, if we couldn't have found some peace back in the 50s and 60s when the issues of institutionalism came along. Well, first of all, I cringe at the thought of casting judgment on people who were involved in things that I was not involved with. But secondly, when people stood up, I'm sure that there were people teaching the truth who did so perhaps cruelly and perhaps without any patience. But when people stood up and taught the truth, and especially men that I know who stood up and taught the truth and fought that fight, they were not fighting a fight of personalities. It was not just a simple disagreement between this fella who lived in this county and that fella who lived in that county. And they were arguing because of territorial disputes. One was teaching the truth and one was teaching false doctrine. And this man did not have a right to say, "Let's find some peace in the middle." Because he's teaching the truth of God's Word. Just like Saul didn't have a right to say, "Let me show mercy to King Agag." That's not his call. That's not his right. And I'm afraid there are people who think that they have the ability to be more merciful and more kind than God. Where God has not shown mercy and where God has not shown patience, they say, "Well, we will. We will allow this peace." And let me also suggest that you can only have peace with people who hold and cling to false doctrine. The only way you can have peace with them, people will turn to Ephesians 4 and say, we need to pursue that unity of the Spirit. The only way you can have unity of the Spirit is if everybody comes to the Spirit. The only way you can have peace with people who cling to false doctrine is if you leave the Spirit. You can have peace with them, but it's only at the cost of peace with God. And that's what Saul found. He could have peace with King Agag, but he had to give up peace with God to have it. It's God's call. It's God's battle. And when we're fighting His battles, then we cannot loose where He has not loosed. And we cannot permit where He has not permitted. And so Saul took on himself responsibilities that were not his. Were not his right. Secondly, let me suggest to you that what Saul did is easy to minimize. It's easy to turn Saul's sin or to consider Saul's sin as a minor infraction. And certainly Saul puts it in those terms as he speaks to Samuel here. Basically, he's saying, I did everything you asked me with just a couple of exceptions. You know, his language kind of reminds me when I was a kid and I would bring my report card home and my parents would say, how did you do? And I'd say, I made straight A's and B's and one C and one D. But other than that, it was straight A's and B's. Well, I didn't make straight A's and B's. and here is Saul saying, I did exactly what God told me with minor details. I saved this and I saved this. The fact of the matter is, Saul didn't do anything that he didn't want to do. He only destroyed what he wanted to destroy, and he salvaged, I suggest to you, everything he wanted to salvage. As you look in the language there, what it suggests is basically that if they had thought that something else was good, they would have saved that too. And so basically they go in and they did their bidding from start to finish. It's not that they rejected God in this one point. They rejected God entirely. And they acted entirely on their own whims. You know, it is one thing for us to plead misunderstanding. It is one thing for if Saul had said, I didn't quite grasp what you meant. I thought you meant we needed to destroy the whole army. That's not what he's saying here. He's not saying I didn't see the extent to which you meant me to go. And he's not saying we went in there and tried to destroy everybody, but these people got away. These sheep and these oxen were brought back without my knowledge. I didn't even know King Agag was over there. He was hiding from us. It's not that he said we set out to do it and we just fell short. What he's saying is we didn't want to do it. And so we didn't. We just decided to do something else. And what that means is it is the sin, as Samuel would describe it towards the end of the text that we read, it is the sin of a rebellion. It is insubordination. It is him turning to God and saying, I know better than God. I think we need to be careful not to overlook the sin of rebellion when it rears its head. Sometimes it can rear its head in such a small way that we have a tendency to say, well, that's just not that big of a deal. You know, with your children do some things sometimes that are just foolish and silly, and they come out of ignorance. And you know, there's those occasions when they do something and you just shake your head and you say, what were you thinking? And you have to punish them and you have to help them learn their lesson and learn to do better. But you know that they weren't being cruel and they weren't being rebellious. They were just being silly. They were being children. And foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child and you have to drive it far from them. But then there's those times where you give your child some direct command and you say, you do not do this. And maybe they even look at you while they're doing it. See what you're going to do about it. I'm going to tell you what. That is the danger. That is what you have to drive out right then and right there. And I think that I have talked with people before about raising children. When we first had children, you know, they do not send you home with an owner's manual from the hospital. And if they did, it would probably be worthless. And so we just talked to as many people as we could. And I'll tell you who we went and talked to was people who had godly children. What did you do? And the advice we got had so much to say about rebellion. You watch for that. And you take care to drive that out. And you take care not to have any kind of patience, not any kind of consolation for the rebellious heart. You have patience with the silliness. You have patience with foolishness. Because that's kids being kids. But you don't allow rebellion to grow up. And I think sometimes that I've seen parents who will have far more patience with the rebellion. And they'll allow that disrespect to grow. And they'll allow their children to grow up thinking that they need to have a reason for every little thing they do. And they don't teach them to respect authority. And just that there's sometimes you have to do what you're told. All the while, they flip out over something silly a child did. I knew some parents whose child, we were in a Mexican restaurant one time, and they had ordered her own little bowl of cheese dip. And she took a gum out of her mouth and started dipping it in the cheese dip and sucking the cheese off. And they looked over there, and of course, that's gross. I mean, you know, nobody wants to see that. But she's like three. And they flipped out. What are you doing? And they, I think, even gave her a spanking over it. But now that same child, when I was preaching in the pulpit, would be told by her parents to sit still. And she'd get away and get out into the aisle and come all the way. And I would pick her up in the pulpit and have to take her back to her parents. And about that, they would say, oh, she's just a kid. Now look, I may tell my children not to dip their gum in their cheese dip. But if they grow up to be adults who dip their gum in their cheese dip, then they're weird. But they're not lost. And I'd far rather have kids who grow up being strange Christians than perfectly well-adjusted heathens. And we need to be careful that we give no quarter to that sin of rebellion. I suggest to you that it doesn't take much rebellion for Satan to have what he wants. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, you see Eve falling to the temptation. And it explains, you know, her whole thought process, or at least generalizes for us her thought process. It says, when she saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. And she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. Now, what's so bad about eating one piece of fruit? Well, I'll tell you what's so bad. It was the only thing God told him not to do. You got one rule, and that's all you have to follow. Adam and Eve, have you ever considered that they only broke one rule? I think it's a perfect illustration of what James says over in James chapter 2 and in verse 10. You know, we have a lot of commands and a lot of things to think about in consideration of being obedient to God's law. And so it's maybe hard for us to wrap our minds around the concept of James 2 and verse 10 when it says, for whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. Well, Adam and Eve illustrate that perfectly. There was only one law. There was only one command. And they broke it. And they became lawbreakers. And in some sense, there's still only one command. Do what God says. I mean, Jesus kind of sums that up. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, and all your soul. This is the greatest command. You do what God says. If you see a snake, we were on vacation a while back. We were actually on our way back from a gospel meeting, and we stopped at a park a national park, and there was a cabin there, and there was a snake that's head was sticking out of this log cabin about yay far. Now, only that much of it was sticking out. It turned out as it slinked its way on out, it was about 3 or 4 feet long. But only about this much was sticking out. Now, I didn't say to my kids, well, that's not a dangerous snake because it's only about 3 inches of it sticking out. That much will kill you. You know, that much rebellion is all Satan needs. He just needs his foot in the door. And I suggest to you that any rejection of God's commands on any point, whether it be the way that we raise our children, whether it be the way that we conduct the services, whether it be the way that we speak, the kind of language we use, the way we set our priorities, it doesn't matter what it is. One point where we reject what God has said and Satan is completely satisfied if you do everything else right. Because he's got you. He don't need to have you, you know, start to finish. He just needs one little part of you. And he's content. And I suggest to you that you may think he only had one little part of Saul, but he had him hook, line, and sinker. Well, then look at Saul's excuses back to Samuel. It's a very interesting exchange that you consider there. As you look at what Saul has to say, and particularly as you look at how Samuel kind of reacts to all of that. Samuel, to me, is a perfect example. He's a good character to consider as far as being able to stand in the face of such foolishness as Saul offers. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to deal with an alcoholic or a drug addict. I've not had many opportunities, and it is disquieting every time you do. But what you find is that most of the time, somebody who is addicted to some substance, they are proficient liars. And it is impressive. I mean, they make you think you're the crazy person because they are so convincing in their lies. And it reminds me of that when I read what Saul says here. Oh, I've done it. What are you talking about? You know, it's trying to make Samuel think that he's the one that's being overbearing. Samuel doesn't flinch for a moment. He doesn't think he's in the wrong. He doesn't for a moment say, well, maybe I'm overstepping my bounds here. He knows that Saul has committed evil. And so he doesn't let him get by with anything. Saul, on the other hand, He doesn't care about anything here except making sure that blame doesn't come on him. And he's willing to say anything and place the blame anywhere to keep himself out of trouble. Look at his excuses. He starts with just total denial. I've done what God says. I have obeyed. I mean, it's a, you know, kind of a glad-handling approach as Samuel comes up. Hey, wonderful to see you. I've done exactly what God said. I mean, it's kind of like, well, why'd you bring that up, you know, if you did what God said? When Samuel confronts him with that, then he lays the blame on the people. Consider what that says about Saul. Basically, he's saying, I'm a bad king. I can't keep control of my army. I can't keep control of what these people do. And they did it, even though, of course, I would have done right. But they persisted. And then he makes what's the most distasteful argument to me, and he falls on a religious argument. And he says, you know, the reason we did this is, you know, to offer sacrifice to God. It's our devotion to God is what caused us to do that. Not, certainly not a rebellion against God. We're just trying to be religious. But he gives the lie to that argument when he says, we have done this. There, for instance, in verse 21, so that we could offer sacrifice to the Lord, your God. Again, just like the people that we discussed in chapter 12. He's not devoted to God. And he's just using that as a possible excuse. And I suggest to you, we need to have our senses exercised, as Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 12 speaks of, to discern both good and evil. People will offer excuses. And because we all offer excuses, I think sometimes we are prone to accept them. I was talking last night about a woman who we knew, who we had withdrawn fellowship from at Southeast. Not only had we withdrawn fellowship from her, but we had reports, and she had even spoken to me on occasion about the letters that we sent to her sons, who were also unfaithful, that let us know that she knew she was withdrawn from, and she was mad at us about it. Some tragedy occurred in her family, and she wanted the love and compassion of her brothers and sisters in Christ, and we offered it the best way we knew how, while remembering that we were not in good fellowship. And she said, "Well, I didn't even know that I was withdrawn from." And I know that the brethren who accepted that were good-hearted and meant well. But the fact of the matter was, they were willing to accept the excuses. They were willing to accept the lies of someone who it should have been easy to see through. Her lies were as empty and as shallow as Saul's lies here were to Samuel. People want so badly, they want so badly to be reconciled, they'll basically take any explanation they can grasp a hold of. And we need to be careful that we're not gullible, because we want to be. Because we want that reconciliation. Because we want somebody to be justified when in fact they just are not. Well, we can do the same thing when we're talking about situations of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I can tell you a number of instances where I want so badly for someone to be justified. And I want their marriage to be right, but it's just not. And there's nothing I can do about that. Not only that, but Saul throughout does not for a moment say, "You're right." He doesn't even show a hint of remorse. And I suggest to you what he does is compounds his sin. It is bad enough to commit the sin. It is adding on to that. It is piling on to that to not admit the sin. You commit further sin when you refuse to acknowledge. Compare that to the character of David as it is illustrated in the 19th Psalm. In Psalm 19... and looking there, beginning in verse 12, it says there, "Who can discern his errors? Acquit me of hidden faults. Also keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not rule over me. Then I will be blameless and shall be acquitted of great transgression." David not only is willing to admit his sin and confess his sin, as we see in other places, but here he says, "Even acquit me of things I may not even know about." Saul, when it's put right to his face, is not even willing to admit obvious sin. And here, I suggest to you, is the greatest illustration of why Saul, David is a man after God's own heart, even though he committed grievous sin, and Saul is not. Because when Samuel comes to Saul with the "thou art the man" moment, Saul rejects him. Whereas David breaks down and says, "I sinned against God." We all sin. We all even commit at times rebellious sin. But we can't take the approach. We can't look to excuse ourselves. We've got to have the humility to break down before God as David did and look for forgiveness. Finally, there is the sentence that is pronounced on Samuel. On Saul, rather, by Samuel. As you look at the sentence, it begins there in the verse 22. "And this has the Lord as much delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice," is indeed, you know, a bit of a paradox. Because it's quite clear that God does care about sacrifice. And when people do not offer the sacrifices, they're going to get in trouble. But what it makes clear here is that God will not accept a sacrifice as a means of covering up what you continue to do. You can't say, "I'm going to live my life however I want to live it and hope by good deeds to outweigh the bad that I do." There are people I know who do that, who live their lives the way they want to and hope by writing a little bit bigger check on Sunday to outweigh all of that. Just won't work. There are people I know who live the way they want to and say, you know, I show up on Sundays and I show up on Wednesdays and I show up for gospel meetings. What more do you want? I'll tell you what God says. Everything you got. Your whole life. Every waking moment is what I want. And so it's not enough simply to try to find some quick solution. And I suggest to you also, it's not enough to simply come to the front pew every time somebody finds out about what you've been doing. That is not going to be something that God accepts either. He wants a broken and contrite heart, as David speaks of in Psalm 51. But notice also that he reiterates that this is not just an overlook. This is rejection of God. One of the things that it amazed me how quick my children learned was the word accident. And do you know that no matter what they do, and if they get in trouble for it, it's an accident? You can watch them pick up an item, walk across the room, and slap their sister in the head with it, and say, "What did you just do?" "It was an accident." You can see the intent, and they'll still say, "It was an accident." Well, guess what? We do that as adults too. And I hear it all the time. A man cultivates a relationship inappropriately that he began online, and I know he didn't mean to. I mean, I know, just like David, he didn't set out saying, "I'm going to commit fornication." But that thing continues for months and months, and then it escalates, and then lo and behold, they're in fornication, adultery. And what does he want to say? "Well, I didn't mean to." "Well, I know you didn't want this to happen. But it wasn't an accident. You rejected God and you went down this path." And so let's not minimize what our sin is. And let's not minimize the sins and those that are closest to us. And say, "Well, you know, he really didn't mean to get into all of that. You know, Samson didn't mean to get into all he got into." But a rejection of God is what it is. And it's what's being punished here. We need to be wary of that. But also consider what happens next. The kingdom of God is not immediately stripped from Saul, even though he says, "You've been rejected." And he go on and say that, "I found someone better than you." It's not immediately that it occurs. In fact, it's quite a lingering affair as you continue to read the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. And it's really a tumultuous affair. But basically what God says is, "I'm leaving you on your own." And he's left to reign without God's help. And that's a sure punishment. It's just taking it away. In fact, it might have been better for Saul if he had just had it stripped from him right then. Because what happens is Saul just runs that thing in the ground. He's so bitter and he's so angry and so focused on killing David, who ought to have been a national hero, and turning him into a criminal, that he lets the whole country go to pot. If you look at the map, when Saul began his reign, this is approximately the area of control that Israel had. By the end of his reign, that control had shrunk to the area in orange that you see there. Pitiful. And he basically, there was even a time where he's chasing after David and the Philistines, and the only reason he has to pull back is he's got to do something about the Philistines before they just completely take over. Of course, he would eventually fall to them. That's the way he would lose his life. I suggest to you that God may not strike you dead right here like Ananias and Sapphira if you reject him. But if you reject him out of your life, then you're going to run yourself in the ground. And you're going to find yourself in as pitiful a circumstance as Saul. And at the end of your life, you might find yourself grasping at straws just as badly as he did, as he would go to a witch of Endor to go try to find some communication with God. He'd lost all communication with God. Just let me speak to Samuel one more time. Just give me some peace, something. And I'll tell you what, Samuel didn't have anything comforting to say to him. But I suggest to you that there's nothing here to indicate the kingdom's gone. I mean, Saul can't get that back. But at any point, he could have at least turned back to God and salvaged what dignity there was left. He could have, like David, when he was told, "You're not the one who's going to build the house of God." David didn't say, "How dare you?" He said, "Fine, then I'll prepare for the one who is." Saul could have said, when God said, "That's it. Your lineage is over. Very well, I'll prepare and I'll make this kingdom ready for the man who's better than me." But that's not what he did. Don't let bitterness and anger over the consequences of some sin that has come into your life overwhelm you and cause you to turn your back on God as Saul did. You certainly have the opportunity this evening. If you recognize rebellion in your life, if you recognize that there's even some corner of your life where you hold back and continue in some character, some habit that you know that God has called you to put away, then I urge you to recognize that, to take the warning that we see with Saul. Don't fall into that trap of self-justification. You ever found yourself in a corner on something? Maybe something that you've done all your life and you've believed is right, and you get backed into that corner. You got two options there. You know, you could either just surrender and say, "I don't have an answer. And even though this is what I've always known, I'm going to put it to the side and follow what God says." Or you can say, you can begin to just grasp at straws. And you can just begin to pull arguments out of the air and just do anything you can to avoid that accusation, to avoid the difficulty of having to do something different than what you've done. It looks foolish when you see it in others. It looks foolish when we see Saul doing it. Sometimes we need to take a step aside from ourselves and look and see, do I look that ridiculous? Am I trying to make those same foolish statements of self-justification? If you are, just let go of that. Let Samuel's, let the words like Samuel's have the effect that they ought to have had. Let it have the effect that Nathan's words had on David. Again, rejection of God doesn't mean you have to scream from the rooftops and proclaim that God is not your master. Rejection of God doesn't mean that when I offer the invitation this evening, you need to get up and give me an audible no, I will not have it. As we've said before, rejection of God just means all you got to do is sit there and do nothing. And I hope that if you're in need of correction in your life before God, that you will not make that rejection this evening, but you'll take action and begin to live your life according to God's pattern and begin to fight His fight and not our own, so that we may find peace and happiness, especially eternally, with Him in heaven. If there's any way that we can assist you, won't you come forward? We would rejoice if you would, while we stand and while we sing.